It doesn't seem to be a day that goes by when the Trump administration doesn't have a swat at South Africa. Today was another one, the US Human Rights Report, which elevates the concerns that the Americans and in particular the White House have about what's going on in South Africa. But have they got it right? Well, there are few South Africans who would say we live in a perfect country. Our transition has been difficult. It's taken more than three decades already, and it seems sometimes that we take two steps backwards to go one step forward. But generally, we do understand where we are going wrong, and we also get pretty irritated when people don't see that we are trying, and in fact, a lot of what they allege is actually not true. This has not helped. The whole situation has not helped at all when South Africans go abroad and tell a story that isn't entirely accurate and turn a blind eye towards some pretty horrific disinformation. We've asked our friends at Google to take a deep dive into this latest US human rights report, having a look at that and, of course, the South African government's response, which looks at interesting issues, including the pig farm murders that have grabbed so much of the headlines here. It's a balanced piece, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a really complex and often debated topic, the human rights situation in South Africa.
Yeah, it's a nation that gets a lot of global attention, doesn't it? And the recent headlines, well, they're certainly making waves.
Absolutely. What's fascinating here, I think, is how wildly different stories can emerge from, well, the very same events.
Exactly. You start digging and you find a lot of conflicting information out there. It can be confusing.
Right. So to help you cut through that noise and really get a handle on what's going on, we've pulled together quite a stack of recent reports and official statements.
We're talking a real mix here, a major U.S. human rights report, South Africa's own official responses, independent fact-checking, even statements right from the South African presidency.
Our mission today is simple. We want to help you look at these different perspectives, pull out the key insights, and understand the facts on the ground, you know, without getting overwhelmed.
Think of it as your shortcut to getting properly informed on this really critical issue.
Okay, let's unpack this complicated picture then.
So maybe we should kick off with the U.S. State Department's South Africa 2024 Human Rights Report.
Good idea. It makes a pretty strong claim right from the start, doesn't it? Saying the human rights situation significantly worsened during the year.
It does. And it really zooms in on one specific event from last December, the signing of the expropriation bill, B23-2020.
Right, the expropriation bill. Now, just for context, this basically allows the government to take private land, maybe without compensation, for certain public needs. The U.S. report calls this signing a substantially worrying step towards land expropriation of Afrikaners and further abuses against racial minorities. That's pretty strong language.
It really is, and that's a key point they make. The report then lists several other issues. It found credible accounts of things like arbitrary or unlawful killings, arbitrary arrests, detention.
And what it calls the repression of racial minorities.
Exactly. And crucially, it claims the South African government did not take credible steps to investigate, prosecute, and punish officials for these abuses. It even mentions things like inflammatory racial rhetoric and violence against racial minorities.
Okay, so that's the U.S. perspective. But this is where the narratives really clash, isn't it? Because South Africa's Ministry of International Relations and Cooperation, they came back hard.
They did. They issued a statement. South Africa rejects U.S. human rights report, expressing profound disappointment. They called the U.S. report inaccurate and deeply flawed.
And said it fails to reflect the reality of our constitutional democracy. Strong words back.
DeRoe's core argument is that the U.S. report uses contextual information and discredited accounts. They specifically point to the pig farm murders incident. The U.S. report flagged that as an unlawful killing.
Mm-hmm.
But DeRoe counters that this case is actively adjudicated by our independent judiciary.
Mm.
They basically say the U.S. calling it that is premature and a fundamental distortion of the facts.
So they're saying, hey, let the courts do their job. It's not just that one incident either.
No. D'Arcio also mentions police force incidents, but says South Africa has robust processes for investigations through its own constitutional bodies.
And they didn't stop there. They kind of turned the tables, criticizing the U.S.'s own human rights record.
Yeah, mentioning the U.S. exit from the UN Human Rights Council, perceives lack of accountability, and highlighting significant and documented concerns about human rights within the United States, like treatment of refugees, issues with ICE, and due process.
It's a clear pushback.
And what's really crucial here is the counter evidence D'Arcio brought up regarding the Expropriation Act itself.
Ah, yes, the land issue again.
They point out that the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva described South Africa's Land Expropriation Act as a critical step in addressing the country's racially imbalanced land ownership. They underscored its integrity and its human rights-based nature.
So the UN view seems quite different from the U.S. State Department's framing.
Exactly. It shows this isn't just a simple factual disagreement. It gets into how human rights reporting can bump up against national sovereignty. You know, external criticism can feel like an attack on internal judicial processes.
Here's where it gets really interesting, then. We have two very different stories emerging about the same country.
This raises an important question. How do we reconcile such contrasting viewpoints? And what specific details can help us understand the nuances?
Well, maybe looking closer at that specific case, they both mentioned the pig farm murders, might help us understand these different interpretations. The BBC reported some really grim details about this incident near Polokwane.
Very grim. Two women killed, Maria Magado and Lucien Lovu. And the really disturbing allegations were that their bodies were supposedly fed to pigs to get rid of the evidence.
Just awful. And now there's a legal twist, which adds another layer and shows just how complex these ongoing cases can be.
Right. The BBC reported that one of the accused, Adrian De Wet, a young farm worker, he recently walked free. Charges withdrawn.
He walked free? How?
He's now a state witness. He claims he was forced under duress, is the term used to dispose of the bodies. And he alleges it was the farm owner, Zachariah Olivier, who actually shot and killed the women.
Wow. Okay. So Olivier and another accused worker, William Musora, they're still behind bars.
That's right. But you can imagine the emotional impact. Walter Magado, the brother of one victim, expressed real outrage. He feels justice might not be served properly with this development.
I can understand that. In this case, it seems to have tapped into much deeper issues.
Absolutely. The BBC reported it exacerbated racial tension, especially in rural areas. It really highlights that difficult legacy of apartheid. You know, most private farmland still held by the white minority, while most farm workers are black, often poorly paid.
Which fuels resentment. But then you also hear from white farmers about high crime rates. It's a really fraught situation.
It is. And this specific case perfectly shows why the U.S. report might cite it as an unlawful killing, focusing on the alleged act itself.
While DRCO insists it's actively adjudicated, focusing on the ongoing legal process.
Exactly. It highlights the challenge of reporting on live court cases, especially when they touch on such raw nerves like race and land.
So what does this all mean when we have a live legal case being described so differently by official reports?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights the challenge of reporting on ongoing legal processes, especially when they touch on deeply sensitive societal fault lines like racial tension and land.
That pig farm case really does show how deep those historical tensions run, especially around land. And that brings us to another really contentious area, farm murders and the misinformation surrounding them.
Oh, definitely. You've probably seen some of those claims flying around online, especially linked to the new expropriation law.
Yeah, things like 60 white farmers are killed every day, or over 4,000 farmers killed since 2018. Really shocking numbers, if true.
And these claims got amplified, didn't they, by figures like Donald Trump accusing the SA government of illegally confiscating land, and Elon Musk talking about openly racist ownership laws.
Which is precisely why independent fact-checking is so crucial here. AFP Fact Check did a piece, South African Farm Murders, Debunking Disinformation.
And what did they find?
Well, they flatly debunked these figures, calling them exaggerated and baseless.
So what are the real numbers, according to more credible sources?
AFP cited groups like the Transvaal Agricultural Union and Afroforum. They report around 50 farmers of all racial groups are killed annually, not daily, annually. TIUSA said 50 in 2023, 32 so far in 2024. The average of the last decade is about 63 deaths per year.
Okay, 50 or 60 a year is still tragic, obviously, but it's vastly different different from 60 a day.
Hugely different, especially when you consider South Africa recorded over 19,000 murders nationally just between January and September 2024. That context makes these 60 farm murders per day claim look, well, wildly off.
What stands out to you here, it's easy to get lost in the sensational, but the data tells a very different story.
For me, it's how easily these specific, often tragic, incidents get twisted and amplified for political reasons. It shows how historical grievances around land become fuel for disinformation.
Absolutely. And if you look at the racial demographics of the victims, it adds another layer. A 2017 brief noted that since 1990, about 87.6% of farm murder victims were white, while white people are about 8.4% of the population. So disproportionately affected in that specific crime category.
But you have to remember the history, right? The 1913 Natives Land Act literally stopped black people from buying land. Even though that's long gone, white minorities still held about 72% of commercial farmland as recently as 2017.
Precisely. That history is why this issue is so politically charged. A security analyst, Lizette Lancaster, pointed out it's often framed by specific interest groups as a white genocide.
But she argues it actually affects all South Africans. Crime is widespread.
Yet the narrative can have real impact. You mentioned the U.S. diplomatic spokeswoman, Tammy Bruce, saying in February 2025, the U.S. was ready to take in persecuted South African farmers as refugees.
It shows how far these narratives can travel.
This highlights how essential critical thinking is in a world of information overload, especially when deeply emotional issues intersect with politics and history. Another analyst, Johan Berger, he called for a credible and unified central database for farm attacks, specifically to fight this kind of misinformation. Makes sense.
Definitely. Now, shifting focus slightly beyond these specific legal cases and land issues, South Africa also faced major civil unrest back in July 2021. And the government's own reflection on that gives us another important perspective.
Right. President Cyril Ramaphosa himself gave a pretty stark assessment of that period. He called it a deliberate, coordinated, and well-planned attack on our democracy.
Strong words. He said the aim was to cripple the economy, cause social instability, and severely weaken or even dislodge the democratic state.
And the scale was huge. Over 50 billion rand lost to the economy, massive destruction mainly in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, tragically 337 deaths, and thousands arrested, 3,400 arrests.
Ramaphosa argued that the instigators cynically took advantage of society's most vulnerable. They exploited the tough social and economic conditions, made worse by COVID, to try and spark a popular insurrection alongside opportunistic acts of looting.
He described it as using chaos as a smokescreen for targeted economic sabotage, hitting trucks, malls, factories, blocking major roads.
And significantly, he pointed to well-orchestrated campaigns on social media to inflame racial tensions, spread fake news, and disseminate misinformation. That theme again.
The government was quite open about its failings, though. They admitted, we were poorly prepared for an orchestrated campaign of public violence, destruction, and sabotage of this nature.
That's quite an admission. Ramaphosa was clear, though. He categorized it not as a popular uprising of the poor, but specifically as an attempted insurrection.
A very deliberate distinction.
And following that, based on reporting like from the Africa report, they seem to have taken quite a few steps to fix things. Strengthening security clusters, filling vacancies in state security, improving intelligence sharing, beefing up public order policing.
Holding more frequent National Security Council meetings. Appointing new leadership in police and intelligence. It shows a state trying to learn and adapt after a major shock.
This provides crucial context on the challenges of governance and public perception during a crisis, and the importance of clear communication from leadership. But there was that one controversial aspect early on, wasn't there? Ramaphosa's comment about ethnic mobilization.
Yes. On July 11th, 2021, he initially suggested that was fueling the unrest.
And his reasoning was based on reports of social media posts, things like hashtag Cyril must resign, but also phrases that translated roughly to Venda people stand aside, we real people are fixing our affairs, and we will not be ruled by a Venda.
Yeah, apparently there was even graffiti saying Ramaphosa must go back to Venda.
Here's a good story to illustrate how things can be perceived versus the actual ground truth, though, because he clarified that pretty quickly, right?
He did. By the next day, July 12th and later, he stated that this was not, in fact, a prominent factor. He emphasized that the majority of our people have, out of principle, refused to be mobilized along these lines.
So walking back that initial assessment.
Exactly. He concluded by asserting the assault on our democracy failed because the people of South Africa would not allow it. It shows a leader adjusting their narrative based on more information, which is important in fast-moving situations.
Okay, so let's try and bring all these threads together. We've covered a lot of ground today, navigating a pretty complex picture. We saw the U.S. Human Rights Report painting quite a concerning view,
highlighting issues like the expropriation bill, alleged abuses, lack of accountability. A quite critical stance.
But then we saw South Africa's official response from DRECO, pushing back strongly, calling the report flawed, defending their judicial processes, and even citing the UN Human Rights Office's more positive view on the Land Act.
Then we zoomed in on the pig farm murders, a specific, tragic case showing how ongoing legal battles can be framed very differently and how deeply connected they are to those historical tensions around race and land.
And we tackled the farm murder issue head on, looking at the shocking disinformation figures versus the actual statistics from reliable sources. It really drives home how important it is to check facts, especially on such emotive topics.
Absolutely. Distinguishing credible data from politicized narratives is key.
Finally, we looked at the government's own analysis of the 2021 unrest, acknowledging failings but framing it as an attempted insurrection, not a popular uprising, and taking steps to prevent recurrence.
And noting the clarification around the initial ethnic mobilization comments.
Right. So understanding these specific cases, the land bill debate, the farm murders, reality versus myth, the analysis of the unrest, it really gives you, the listener, a much richer, more nuanced grasp of the human rights landscape in South Africa than just reading headlines.
It's about getting that deeper understanding quickly but thoroughly.
So maybe a final thought to leave you with.
Given all these diverse sources, these conflicting accounts we've explored today, what does this deep dive maybe suggest about the nature of truth itself and how news gets reported in our, you know, super connected, information-heavy world?
And perhaps, how might you apply this kind of critical lens when you encounter other complex international issues? Something to think about.